welcome everyone to the Yacht Racing Podcast and to the fifth of our weekly Vendée Globe special episodes. I'm Justin Chisholm, the editor of the yachtracing.life website, and I'm joined, as ever, by my expert guest, Vendée Globe 2016-17 skipper, Conrad Coleman.
G'day, nice to be here, especially after this week. It feels like a really good week to have your feet warm and dry on shore.
You're not wrong. Conrad, what a week for the Vendée Globe skippers. I mean, we've seen plenty of action in this race so far, and we always expect lots of action. But last week was truly remarkable, wasn't it?
Yeah, it certainly was. And I'd just like to sort of imagine, if you will, what it's like for the sailors to be out there. You're just going underneath the longitude of the Cape of Good Hope. You've got this sort of 10,000-mile tunnel of the Southern Ocean sort of unfurling in front of you. And just as you're sort of getting into the meat of the race, you've got major impacts hitting boats sort of left and right. You've got boats dropping like flies. And not only did you have the sort of relatively run-of-the-mill standard stuff like sort of foils and small sort of running damage that we're used to, as you've got this sort of legendary mid-sea rescue, the likes of which we haven't seen in several editions during this race. You know, it reminds me very, very clearly of the 1996 rescue of Pete Goss picking up Raphael Dinelli from his upturned boat, and obviously the closure of the story of Vincent Rayou picking up Jean Le Cameron back in 2009. When his keel had failed. So, you know, it's really going back and cementing the gnarly reputation of this race.
That's right. And I mean, what we're talking about here is the rescue of Kevin Escoffier on PRB when his boat just folded in half, basically. And we'll come on to that in a second. But it is one of these Vendée Globe classic moments that this race just seems to create. Happily, it worked out well, and everybody is safe. And as I say, we'll come on to that in a second. But the other story, which in a normal run of Vendée Globe action would have been the big story, was that after all of Alex Thompson's work the previous week that we covered in the last podcast, where he'd repaired the boat and was back in the race, and I was even prompting you whether we could see a British comeback, and you were ribbing me about my my national tendencies, yeah. And suddenly he's out of the race with a broken rudder. I mean, just it's hard not to say this guy is jinxed when it comes to the Vendée Globe.
Well, yeah, it's 2020, and just, you know, moments before we started recording this, we saw that Alex has arrived safely in Cape Town. And again, in terms of the cyclical story that I made reference to of Jean Le Cam being picked up and so on, again, we've got the story of Alex Thompson limping into Cape Town. And he first did it back in 2004 during the course of his first Vendée Globe, when in that case he had a gooseneck failure that ripped the deck, ripped the boom out of the deck. And he made it as far as Cape Town before retiring in his first one. Obviously, subsequently, he's gone on to get two podiums and doing pretty well in this race. But it's incredibly frustrating, and because Alex has been an incredibly sort of animated character, particularly in this race. You know, he was cycling is my other big sport that I follow a lot, and you often have these eras of one particular cyclist, being the sort of the boss of the peloton. You know, for a while it was Fabian Cancellara. For a while it was Lance Armstrong, back in the heydays of his doping. and I kind of felt like Alex was sort of stepping into that role, that he had the experience, he had the team, he had the confidence to really bring us into the heart of his race, and frankly the race is poorer as a consequence of his abandonment, and it's a real shame.
It is, and this race is no respecter of reputations or efforts or budget or just the general goodwill that should go along with somebody who's been at this for 20 years. It's just crushed his dream. I mean, can you begin to fathom how that journey back from the race course to Cape Town must have been for him? It's been a few days. I think it was November 28th when he turned his bows towards Cape Town and told the world that he was, you know, pulling out of the race once he got ashore. Can you imagine what he's been thinking all the way home?
Well, I mean, it's one of the things that makes this race particularly brutal is the fact that you don't have an easy out. And even when he reached the point of having structural failure that put him out of contention, it's not like he can just sort of pull the ripcord and be home in a couple of hours and rely on the strength of his community to help sort of get him back together. You know, he's still in the middle of the ocean. He's still got a limp back. And I'm sure that it was particularly stressful sailing the boat with only one rudder. Because as we know, these are, even though his boat is relatively skinny and sort of VMG downwind oriented, it's still a very wide boat. And as soon as it's got any heel on it, if the rudder, the remaining rudder is on the windward side, then the boat is going to spin out very, very quickly. And so I'm sure that it was actually quite stressful sailing the boat back. And that undoubtedly required a lot of his attention to make it back safely, keep the boat going in a straight line. But certainly, you know, having been sort of in a similar position myself, you can't help but obviously pour the pity on yourself and be disappointed about the quick end to your own dreams and that have been unrealized. But certainly, you inevitably think about the supporters and your team and the people that helped put you in that position in the first place, because this is not the solitary exercise that it's made out to be. You know, this is years and years of teamwork to get you to the point when you're out there all alone, and you're not carrying just your own hopes and ambitions, but everybody that's been there with you. And so that's a really tough pill to swallow, because we feel that very, very deeply.
That's a really good point. And there has been a huge outpouring of support for Alex, as you would imagine. But it's come from all around the world, which really gives some truth to, you know, just how international this race really is now. It's easy for us to say, oh, it's a very French race, because, you know, it originates from France, it starts and finishes there, and it comes from the core of that French ocean racing scene. But it's followed by such a global audience now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think that because there are relatively few people that that do make an effort to communicate with that international English-speaking audience, is it means that anybody who does it, and anybody who does it well, as Alex does, then it means that he does connect with people from the crazy Dutchies and the sailing fans in Holland, all the way to Oceania and America, and of course his homeland in Britain. So he is able to sort of soak up the international audience, whereas the French sailors are sort of fighting it out in their own language, trying to keep their story fresh and unique and sort of rise above the chatter. So I think that does sort of contribute to his outsized influence. And it's one that I think that he is very aware of, and one that he carries well. So I'm not at all surprised that it's an international outpouring.
I'm sure right now he probably never wants to see this boat again. The press release and the quote from him this morning was that he he needs a good night's sleep, and then he's going to fly back to the UK, and he's going to spend some well-deserved time with his wife and his kids. And, you know, none of us would begrudge him that for sure. But immediately we start to speculate what could be next for Alex. What will be the next move? Is this the end of Alex Thompson's ocean racing career, or does he start to eye up the Volvo, the ocean race, with a modified version of this boat?
Well, it'd be wrong for anybody except himself to answer that. But I think the only thing that we can say for certainty is what he said very publicly, and that is that he built this boat to be the best single-handed sailing Imoka 60 that he could possibly conceive of. And so the idea of trying to shoehorn four or five other sailors onto that boat when it's been so optimized for one is pretty unlikely. So you know, perhaps you sail the boat back or put it on a ship and bring it back to the UK and then chop it up and put a different cockpit in it. But it's you know, pretty dramatic changes would be required. And who knows? I don't know whether Alex has the appetite for the ocean race or whether Hugh or Boss does. So certainly lots of question marks out there, and it's too early to start speculating, I think.
It is. But we're running a podcast, and it's our job to speculate, I guess, at this stage.
Sorry, but I have too much sympathy for sailors who have to feel these questions when they're not ready to.
absolutely. So we will wait until Alex is ready, and I think that could be a good while before we hear any announcements. But let's move on to the story which eclipsed Alex's retirement from the race, which was Kevin Escoffier on PRB. It's not a new boat, but it's a heavily modified boat with foils added to it and a lot of work done by Kevin to reinforce it and make it ready to go around the world. And it folded up like a banana going down a wave.
It's incredible. You know, there have certainly been a few times in during the course of my sailing career that I have been absolutely astonished that my boat hasn't done what his did. And you know, the forces that they have to withstand and the thousands or millions of stress cycles during the course of a race is absolutely mind-boggling. You know, one of the things that sort of made me chuckle a little bit was the fact that I think it was Yannick Besteven who was on the radio because he had been diverted and was standing by during the rescue. Is Kevin was on Jean's boat just after being picked up, and Yannick said, "Oh well, at least that's the last that we'll see of that boat." And I think that speaks volumes about the fact that this boat has developed a particularly challenging reputation. It was, as you said, it wasn't a new boat. It was built, in fact, in 2010, initially with curved foils, and then it went to straight dagger boards, and then it's on its second generation of these sort of lateral foils. And it was, you know, it was built to be extremely light. It was really pushing the boundaries, and it has a really terrible reputation for finishing races. That often, when it was sailed by Vincent Ayoux, then he was out there in front of the foiling sailors, or really mixing it up with the fastest boats in the fleet, and then something would go ping, and he'd retire. And you know, this is the third Vendée Globe that this race has participated in. It's never made it further than Cape Town. So some of that is down to bad luck for hitting random objects, but some of it is just that the boat was too extreme, and then when it was turboed by putting foils on it, then I think that the structure was just solicited to the point that clearly it let go.
Wow. I mean, that's really an interesting insight to hear, because you know, that wasn't information I was particularly aware of, but you're living in Lorient in the heart of all of this, and that's why we're on the podcast together. Yeah. But let's try and imagine ourselves on the boat. I think the most chilling thing for everybody was just this idea of the boat surfing down a wave, and as Escoffier said later, suddenly the bow is at 90 degrees, and the next thing he can smell is the burning as the electrics on the boat are frying themselves. He did extremely well to get off that boat and into a life raft so quickly, and he had time. He managed to have time to send a message to his shore team.
That's right. I think that that he can be absolutely commended for his effort. And just to put that in perspective, it was reportedly 4 minutes between the boat snapping and him getting into the life raft. And so during that time, as you said, he did send a message to his shore crew saying, I'm sinking, this is not a joke. And then putting on his emergency survival suit, his TPS, thermal protective suit, and putting on a life jacket on top of that, and then launching, cutting free, and then launching his life raft and then getting into it. And to do all of that in 4 minutes is absolutely astonishing. There have been times where it's taken me 4 minutes just to get the suit on, let alone do anything else. You know, Kevin is known as being a very experienced sailor. He is a One Day Globe rookie, but that belies the experience that he has, because he's done the Trophée Jules Verne as part of the Banque Populaire team. He sailed with Brian Thompson. He's sailed with Luc Perron as part of that team. They both said that he is one of the sort of coolest heads and wisest sailors that they've had the experience of sailing with. He's also one of the strongest, and I think that really helps sort of put it in perspective, that you need to be on the absolute top of your game, but you also need to have the discipline, because he had his phone charged and ready to go, plugged in, connected to his team, so that in mere seconds he could send that message. He had his TPS suit immediately accessible. And I think there are lots of sailors, and at times I have been that sailor, that has stacked the survival suit, so and then that renders it essentially inoperable in the case of emergency, because you have to go digging through hundreds of kilos of gear to go and find it. So it really speaks to his experience and discipline as an offshore sailor that he was able to do this.
And interesting, one of the quotes, or perhaps one of the radio interviews that I heard, he said that he had his personal locator was always in his waterproof that he was wearing, and that was something that he kind of a habit he picked up when he was doing fully crewed racing as part of the Dongfeng crew during the ocean race. And again, it's just that not having to think about it, because it's on your person.
Yeah, and I think that is one of the takeaways that we can draw from this, and that is that there's no point in having a seatbelt if you don't put it on, and the parallel to that is there's no point in having the safety equipment if it's inaccessible or inoperable. I've sailed on countless boats where I get on board and I find that the life raft is at the bottom of an anchor locker and it's got sort of 6 months of stuff buried on top of it, and I think that I had cold chills hearing about his story, not only because I know him and also his wife and his kids, and I was obviously thinking about them during the time that he was waiting to be rescued by Jean, but it reminded me very much of the experience that I had, where I had to recover Sam Goodchild, who's currently part of the Sodebo all-team. He and I sailed partially around the world together in 2011 as part of the Global Ocean Race, and he went over the side and I had to recover him in very similar conditions, actually. You know, significant swell, gusting 30-plus knots, and then sort of managing a boat single-handed to go around and get him. And the lessons that we drew from that is that you need to make it fail safe. You need to have all of the gear with you on your body so there's no excuse in not having it with you. But also, one of the things that Jean said is that it was incredibly difficult to find him. And just to talk about the resources that were brought to bear in this recovery, is that you had the race committee that were doing calculations on his life raft drifting in the sea. So they were basically doing routine algorithms to figure out where his life raft was going to be drifting, so that they could give an updated position to Jean so that he could find it. He eventually found it, but then apparently he had problems with his own boat, sailed away from him a little bit, and then couldn't find him when he came back. And then it took significant looking for Jean to find him again. And that's when you do have a personal locator beacon, an EPIRB, a flashing light in the middle of the darkness, you know, everything on his side. So I think that it should really be a moment of reflection, and I think that all of the recreational sailors listening to this should really challenge the plan, the security plan that they have for their own boat and their own crew, because we saw that with some of the most experienced sailors in the world and all of the resources brought to bear, it was still incredibly difficult, and we don't have access to those kind of things every time that we go sailing the Solent or in on this channel, which That's means right. that the onus is on us to get it right.
Very true, very true. Wise words. And I think some of that technology that they used to plot the drift of the life raft was actually designed to track oil spills. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I think so. It's all part of the same kind of algorithm.
Which, yeah, I mean, just fantastic that the Vendée Globe race committee, you know, they've got access to this. You know, this is at their fingertips. This is the stuff that they can wield in these situations. And it, I was talking during the week to a non-sailor about this, and you know, I was trying to explain just how experienced this Vendée Globe team is now, based on all of the races and all of the rescues that have gone on. I mean, they are the best in the world at it, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And the race committee is not just there sort of drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes and watching dots on the screen. You know, they've got a lot of expertise, having interacted with them both before and during crises of my own. I know that that they are sort of forecasting what could possibly go wrong before it does go wrong. They have action plans in place. They're really on top of their stuff. They're very impressive.
Certainly are. Also very impressive, Jean Lacam. I don't really know where to start with this guy. Just going to say that if you are in a life raft in the Southern Ocean, the guy you want looking for you in that fleet is definitely Jean Lacam, 61 years old, highly experienced, and he just didn't give up, did he?
No, certainly not. And I, to be fair, I don't think anybody would, because when you're there, you're very aware of the fact that you've got somebody's life in your own hands. Sadly, having experienced that myself, it really does flip a switch. When you realize it's a survival situation, then you will go to the ends of the earth to make sure that you're performing at your very best. But it's important to be able to keep your sort of cold-blooded calm and be conscious of the consequences and of the significance of the situation, which is to say you've got somebody's life in your hands, but then put that aside and focus on the job at hand. And that's what his experience allowed him to do.
Certainly did. And I mean, the adrenaline must have been pumping, but he does strike me as somebody who just has ice water in his veins, because he seems completely unflappable. I've interviewed him at times, and it's one of the most terrifying experiences of my life.
Interviewing John Lacam.
Yeah, because this is not somebody who can be trivialized, you know, or wants to answer trivial questions. So you have to be very careful.
No, but he is a teddy bear. He's lovely. He's a really nice guy. So he's got ice water in his veins. But sadly, we've got a number of boats out there that have got ice water in their boats.
Oh, that's a nice transition. So tell us what you're talking about.
Well, we've got two other boats out there that are having significant problems. That we've got Seb Simon on Archea Paprec and Sam Davies on her boat, Initiative Girl. They are currently heading northwards, perhaps towards Cape Town, perhaps just to sort of get out of the worst of the storms and into calmer conditions. But it's both down to your old favorite, the OFNI, as the French say it, or a strike with an unidentified floating object. UFOs are not fun.
No. And really, 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 really disappointing for both of these skippers to encounter this. I think Sam Davis is very popular with lots of people. She's been at this a while. She's one of the few female skippers, prominent female skippers in the sport. And was rolling along pretty nicely until the keel strike. And then Seb Simon, again, you could just see how upset he was by having to kind of divert out of the race in the videos that he sent back from the boats. It was kind of heartbreaking to see with both of them. You could hear it in their voices.
Yeah, well, you know, these are, remember, these are multi-year projects, and you're carrying the hopes and expectations every single day for, you know, thousands of days in the lead up to this race. And just to, for those that haven't sort of brought themselves up to speed on what it is that we're talking about, it looks like Sam Davies struck something with her keel, so not with her foil, and that has crumpled some of the longitudinal structural members around her keel. And that has led to her leaking from around the keel box. And the concerns are whether the structure of this very highly loaded part of the boat can withstand continued sailing, or as we saw with Alex, Vonnie Globe sailors do have significant composite repair kits on board. But the question is whether she has enough material and enough glue, and given the fact that everything is sopping wet and salty, that she'll be able to effectuate a repair that'll hold together. And then for Seb, he struck something with his foil. And remember, this is not his first rodeo. He is on his third set of foils in 1 year, which when you consider the price of them is just absolutely mind-blowing. And that's because he's been having sort of unsolicited structural failures in the sense that they've just been falling up and breaking. And then it looks like he actually hit something, and they've significantly reinforced the foil so that the foil itself got a little bit crumpled on the trailing edge. But the foils now appear to be stronger than the boat they're attached to. So the lower bearing on the inside of the foil casing, the one that absorbs all the shock, appears to have dismantled the inside of his boat, basically. And so the problem is the lower bearing is at the exit of the foil, obviously, and that has broken the daggerboard or the foil case away from inside the boat. And so now he's got a big hole in the boat, but equally he's got this big composite member that is now free or dislodged inside the boat. And because he has retracted the foil, he's got a sort of 250 or 300 kilos of foil that's acting as a lever arm that's sort of torquing this daggerboard case around. So it's going to be tough to fix because he's leaking. It's a very highly loaded area, which has already failed. And so again, you know, that may be too much for the composite repair kit that he's got on board. And there's a question as to whether he can actually keep the foil on board. He may have to ditch it at sea in order to save the rest of the boat.
You wouldn't be betting on these two boats continuing with the race, would you, based on what we've just talked about?
I think it's tough. If I was a betting man, I would put my money on Sam in the circumstances. She's more experienced, and I think that she's got more. I may not be making friends here. I think she's got more grit out of the two skippers. But also, I think that she's more likely to be able to do a proper repair, whereas trying to make a daggerboard or the foil case safe, not only watertight, but maybe structural again, I think that's the harder repair of the two.
Well, we'll wait and see exactly how those scenarios play out. Meanwhile, at the front of the fleet, it's all going on as well, isn't it? The racing continues unabated. And Louis Burton is the new hero at the moment. He is on an absolute charge, up to second place, taking a much more southerly route than the others. What do we know about this guy?
Well, Louis is a little bit of a sort of black sheep in the field, primarily because he lives in Saint-Malo. So he's not a true sort of Breton sailor who's based in Port-au-Fleuret or Lorient. And so he's always a little bit on the periphery of the class and doesn't train very much with the rest of the boats. And actually his wife is part of the Escoffier family. And so I think that his wife is Kevin's cousin. So, you know, a small world. What do we know about him? He's on his third Vendée. He did 2012, where he hit a fishing vessel and sort of started off with a pretty rocky start because he abandoned shortly thereafter. He did a very very fast, pretty unremarkable, but clearly demonstrated that he was a good sailor in 2016 with an older boat. And then they bought the winner of the 2016. Boat, the old Banque Populaire, Armel Cliache's boat, and has sort of done relatively well with it in the past 4 years. But he was not considered a favourite because he didn't turbo his boat, he didn't modify it with bigger foils. But I think that speaks to the fact that there are two ways of going fast in the Vendée Globe. One is that you try and increase the speed or the theoretical potential of your overall package, and that's what made everybody so excited about the new generation of 2020 boats, because they could sail 10, sometimes 20% faster than their cousins from 2016. Or you can have a fully tested, well-proven boat and fully exploit the potential of what you have. And I think that's what we're seeing here with Louis, is that the breakages, for example, Alex and the foil problems that we've had on the breakages and the problems with Alex, the return of Charles, the fact that we haven't seen the best from Occitane yet. We've been seeing the new fleet have really been struggling to demonstrate their true speed and their true value, whereas Louis, who would lose in a straight drag race against these boats, is now up to second place and is sailing faster at times than a Bivier. So yeah, he's doing really, really well.
And this southerly route that he's taking, I guess he's going round the narrower bit of the world, or the smaller circumference a little bit. But he's kind of put himself in the way of some pretty nasty weather. He must be confident in that boat.
Yeah, he's confident in the boat, that's for sure. And he's what's very impressive at the moment is that he's sailing faster in straight line speed at times than Charlie Dallard. But if you look at his angles, he's also sailing less miles. So he's further south than the fleet, so that gives him a few less miles to sail on the race course. His race course is shorter. The route on that race course is shorter because he's sailing deeper angles and he's sailing faster. So you have three things in his favor, which means that he's gaining ground on the fleet. And yes, as we say, clearly he has confidence in the boat, and maybe the fact that that his 2016 generation boat has smaller foils means that he can whip it just a little bit harder, whereas the 2020 boats have to back off earlier in these stronger conditions.
It's tremendously exciting to see these different approaches and to have the racing so close at the front of the fleet. Conrad, just before we close this podcast down for this episode, a word about the Jules Verne trophy attempts by Sodebo. Where are they up to? Just quickly.
Yeah, sure. Well, at the moment, they're not pointing the right way, which is never a good way to break a record. The thing that's tricky about it is that the current record held by EDEC is obviously held by a non-foiling but fast and proven. So it's kind of brings us back to the same point that we were just making regarding the contrast between Charlie and Louis. In this case, Louis is the EDEC Explorer, the one that currently holds the record. And so Devo is a faster boat, but has more challenging weather relative to the one that the EDEC had a number of years ago when they did break this record. And so they've been driving their way, sort of heading further south. And looks like they're going to connect with a depression that's going to push them towards towards the east. Man, I spent too much time speaking French. I should really speak more English these days. So they'll be heading eastwards very shortly, and the key moment is in the next couple of days as to whether they get sufficient shove from behind from this new depression that they're just hooking into, or whether it peters out and they're unable to sort of daisy chain that into the next system. So they're going fast. They haven't broken anything. They're still flying over the waves, in contrast to Gitana, who pulled the ripcord and went home. So it's all to play for right now. It's exciting to see what happens.
And Gitana, I believe, are back with you and Lorient now. They're going to repair and go back on standby for another attempt.
That's right.
So it's all going on out on the ocean. Thanks so much for this week, Conrad. Really great insight into the from a skipper's point of view into all of this. It's fascinating to hear your comments. Thanks everybody for listening, and we'll be back next week with another Vendée Globe special of the Yacht Racing Podcast. Until then, we'll just say goodbye.
See ya.